Thanks, Alex, and I hope everybody had a good time last night and a valuable first day of the session. A very warm thanks to the speakers yesterday, and especially a very warm thanks to the speakers in today's sessions. I think we actually have an extremely strong session today. I hope you'll all find it very valuable and beneficial. The speakers today are absolutely outstanding. We're very fortunate to have them. Opening the session today will be Ed Dumble. Ed Dumble is the editor-in-chief of Big Data Magazine. I can't think of anything more topically relevant on our theme today than big data and how we address big data, the trends that are coming, and how the information management groups can actually most explicitly understand and bring value to the organizations that they support by understanding big data. Ed's editor-in-chief of the journal Big Data, which was launched recently, in 2012. He's a renowned subject matter expert. Ed's the founding chair of O'Reilly's Strata Conference on Big Data and Data Science, and he's the chair of O'Reilly's Open Source Convention as well. Ed said that he will graciously talk more about himself, so I can cut his intro short. So without further ado, here's Ed. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you very much for having me, everybody, this morning. It's a pleasure to be among librarians again. I don't come from this world, as you may be able to tell by my lack of suit, but the very first time I was invited to give a keynote at the tender age of, I think it was 26, at the XML Europe conference back in the day, I gave an overview of the state of XML at the time, and expressed what I thought was the critical importance of librarians to information management going forward. And this line of librarians, about 10 of them at the back, all let out this amazing cheer. So I've got a room full of you today, and very excited. So I will be accepting questions, and I hope to leave plenty of time for that. Coming to a subject like big data is interesting, given, I think, its large footprint in the news over the last year. It's certainly one of those terms, a bit like social media, that is a little fluffy. It's not entirely sure what it really signifies or how it could be useful, yet there's obviously something there. So it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it. As Tim says, I've been the chair now for 3 years of the Strata Conference, and we noticed 3.5 years ago at O'Reilly that there was something going on with data in organizations, that data was actually the substance around which products were being created. You know, at a very obvious level, something like Google is an entirely a data-oriented business. But people were doing things with data more than just, you know, reporting on it or summarizing it. And we've seen the conference grow. I think our first year we had 1,500 people. That was in 2011 in Santa Clara. We just came off the third edition of that, and we had well over 3,000 come. And this, from my point of view in the tech industry, we're at the height of probably what you'd call a hype wave right now around big data. But one of the reasons for launching a journal, one of the reasons for examining it in the conference, is that there really is something there underneath, and there are genuine reasons why this subject is very important and ways we can understand it. So what I hope to do is provide you this morning with a bit of a framework and a bit of context and some understanding that will help you ask the right questions about your data, and when vendors come to you trying to sell you their solutions, understand where they fit. And also, as your organization changes, how you can help lead that and be part of the change. Right. There we go. So there have been a lot of definitions of big data. Is there anyone in the audience who would feel confident in offering one? No, it's far too early. Well, I'm sure probably in conversation you could manage, you know, to say one or two things to people. And depending on which lens you look through big data, there are, you know, a variety of definitions. If you're in the IT world, you want to sell more boxes. You want to sell more disks or whatever. So the bigness of the data is important to you because people will buy more of your product. And one of the unfortunate things about using the word big in the title is that people think, well, I don't really have big data. I've just got a few gigabytes, or maybe I have a terabyte, but I've heard this is petabytes of data, and it's not applicable to me. I think really, over the last year, what big data has come to mean in the media is more of a tag for analytics, for using data in a smart way. So when I say big data, I do mean all the things that make up the technology underneath. What I mean most is the smart, intelligent use of data to create value. I'm going to go by means of a little story. Now, it's fun to chair a conference called Strata, and turns out there's a great backstory. I wish I could say we named the conference after this guy, but it just turned out there was a historical figure with a nickname Strata. So I'm admitting a secret here that this is a great kind of reinvention of where it came from. But William Strata Smith was really the father of geology in England. He lived over 150 years ago. And he looked at outcrops of rock, and he saw there were fossils in the rock. And he noticed that there were different kinds depending on when the rock was laid down. The second thing he then noticed was that these always occurred in the same order. And by that, he was able to deduce from what actually appeared on the surface of the Earth what then lay below. So he created this first geological map of the UK, showing the location of minerals. As you can imagine, this led to a lot of people becoming incredibly greedy and incredibly rich, because all of a sudden, where they didn't know what was under the ground before, now they had a fair bet of where to look for what they wanted. Now, unfortunately for William Smith, this map was widely plagiarized, and he got no money for it at all, and in fact ended up in the middle part of his life in the poorhouse. He was later emancipated from this and is now very celebrated, but it's an unfortunate little story, but that might underline for us actually the importance of control in the world of data. If you want to know who has the power, look who owns the data and can control its circulation. It was a great example of what I call smart data, using observations, signals, again with some other knowledge, the observation about the fossil order being the same, and creating new value. So why is big data a thing right now? Where does it actually come from? Well, one of the ways to look at this is through the history of our very recent history, sort of 40 years of computers and IT in business. So until maybe, I don't know, say 5-10 years ago, nothing in this history is very clean cut, because of course history happens in a very messy and distributed way. But you know, until a few years ago, the real role of computers in our businesses has been to make what were paper processes faster. So that's been an incredible change in itself. You know, the amount of transactions we can process, and then we can search this information, as you know yourselves, and we don't have to store everything physically. And so this is kind of like the first generation of digital business. But now we're in an interesting transition, because now new business that's being created doesn't really know this kind of paper past. So we're creating businesses that are, you know, what I would call digitally native. So if you think about the process in a business, yes, so, you know, your order processing might be in a computer, but, you know, a few years ago, the customer would phone up, they'd walk into the store, then somebody would give them the product would be delivered. So a lot of the things happen in the physical world, and as far as the computer is concerned, it knows nothing about them. But today, you can see computers reach out their sensors and their tendrils into various parts of businesses. For instance, most supermarkets know exactly what's on their shelves and where things are. Logistics companies know where each package is as they move through the supply chain. Manufacturing companies know the state of their machines, the throughput, and so on. And web companies are in a very interesting position because a lot of them have their entire life cycle in the digital sphere. If you're Amazon delivering ebooks, you contact your customer, you do your sales and marketing digitally, you do the payment digitally, you deliver your product digitally. So now we have all these interactions that are happening in the computer, and really this is the genesis of the reason that we have a thing called big data, is that far more of our world is now measurable. And in a business sense, that is a great advantage. So I like to think of it as we're actually creating a digital nervous system, and big data, in essence, are the signals pulsing through this system. And as you know, many of these signals have been generated by social data and also the web. It's not a surprise, then, that organizations such as Google and Facebook are really at the forefront of pushing some of the technology that has generated this wave. Google had to build a massive search index, and they wanted to do it in a way that was affordable. Their genius in creating their search engine was that they were able to use cheap, unreliable, commodity computers running the open source Linux operating system. They then basically used glue, paper tape, and wire to string all these, things together, their guts hanging out. It wasn't like a data center that you see in the movies. It was, pretty much Heath Robinson affair, but they were cheap. And they instead used software to get around the fact that these computers were unreliable. And so they published a paper on how they used lots and lots of cheap computers to compile their search index using a technique called MapReduce. Now, if you've got a background in computer science and did any functional programming or Lisp, you would recognize that this is actually a concept from programming from 30 years ago. But they figured out how to do it over a bunch of cheap computers on the network. And then, once they published this paper, the Yahoo implemented this algorithm and released it as open source. And they called this system Hadoop. Now, the little yellow elephant at the top left is actually a cartoon Hadoop, which turns out to be the name of Doug Cutting, who's the inventor, his son's toy elephant. And now this stuffed animal is a celebrity and can be seen appearing at various computing conferences from time to time. But the point is that the kind of power that you could only have if you could afford time on a massive computer or be able to pay millions and millions of dollars to companies like Teradata was suddenly available on a cheap commodity basis. I know a colleague of mine is an executive in the Valley, and he actually has a little Hadoop cluster, being six cheap computers running Hadoop in his attic, just to fiddle with, and his wife isn't very pleased about it. But the fact is that right now, any one of us in this room could access this massive data crunching power with just a credit card if you go to Amazon, and that's the sea change that's happened. Big data isn't new. Walmart got where it is by using very smart analytics to get to reduce cost and increase sales. But they did it by investing a heck of a lot of money. But they don't have that advantage anymore because this stuff is commodity. And that's why it's a big deal. And it really is a game changer if you think about something that's previously scarce and expensive becoming very commonly available. So let's talk a bit about, I suppose, the concepts of when it actually comes to the information, what is different with big data? About 15 years ago, Gartner characterized data in an organization as having three axes: volume, velocity, and variety. And this is often how some of the IT world characterize big data, as that it's big and one of these three axes. So obviously, big volume is a very large amount of data, larger than a conventional database can process. In the first instance, this was Google's, web index, all the logs of people accessing their site. In Facebook, it's very obvious that that massive amount of data is there, millions and millions and millions of users and all their likes and their logins and their messages and their funny pictures of cats. Or the data might be going faster than you can normally cope with it. Even today, most business intelligence systems that perform analytics do a nightly load of their database to produce reports. But what happens if you want to do the kind of analytics they do over a nightly batch, in real time, or near real time, because the data is coming in so quickly? Why would you want to do that? Well, some very real reasons. Fraud prevention, for instance, with credit cards. Or in Facebook's case, they do this to inform advertising. If one of your friends likes a new brand of toothpaste on Facebook, then a few minutes later, you might see a toothpaste advert. Because what's happened is when someone likes something, it sets off a computation that adjusts the preferences for what adverts you get shown, not just for you, but for your friends. And this, if you can imagine this scaled up over the hundreds of millions of users on Facebook, is an absolutely massive task. And to do it all within a few minutes is quite phenomenal. The third axis is variety. Now, if you think about databases, you think squares, you think grids, you think orderly data that's been organized and schematized, and you load it in, you clean it up, everything is correct and forced into the right way. But most data in the world does not exist in that sense. It is very often messy, it has errors, it's free form. I know there are, looking around the exhibit hall yesterday, there are companies doing text analytics, and you, I'm sure, certainly understand that not all data comes in a square form, that it's obviously very messy and very different. So variety doesn't just talk about data that's not square, they call it unstructured data, but also it can talk about multiple data sources. As we'll see, there's a lot of value in joining two data sets together. But traditional data warehousing, a lot of the analytics done so far, tend to be over one data set in a very ordered way. So to think about some of the changes, I've talked about Facebook, but think as well, if in your mind, as a comparison between where data was and where data is going now, between mail order catalogs and the kind of thing that Amazon's able to do. Now, for logistical reasons, mail order catalogs typically have segmented their customers into maybe 7 different segments. That's basically all you can afford to do. And that's great for them, they can send that out. But on Amazon, the massive amount of computation they've been able to do and the fact that their product is delivered digitally means you get customized recommendations for you personally. And you know that you go there and you're not just being put in a class of, N people, but everything comes very specifically to you. That's big data at work. And now you will recall the news story last year where now Target are able to produce catalog mailings individually. There's a news story where a father discovered that his teenage daughter was pregnant because the catalog analyzed her buying habits, and I think it was sent her a catalog with diapers and milk and whatever, highlighted vouchers for those things, which is, of course, part of the potentially dark side of being able to compute everything. It's not necessarily healthy to know or to share everything. But the most important thing, the most important detail about big data is the shift from being only able to see a few data points practically in time to being able to sample everything. So the whole field of statistics has really grown on this idea of if you take some sample data, you can use these techniques and make reasonable predictions about the whole population. But what if you can measure the entire population at once? And that's really the big potential of big data, because there are things especially at scale that you just can't see by sampling. And medicine is one of the prime examples where this can make a big change. If you consider things like adverse drug reactions, where cocktails of drugs might, you know, in a very small percentage of the population under certain circumstances have a bad effect, there's very little we can do to join those things up unless we are able to access a large amount of medical records and then analyze these. So part of it is the potential that we have in the technology for analyzing all this data. The second thing is, I'm sure you'll realize in areas like health, is getting to the data in the first place. So a second thing about big data is that it's a kind of mindset change. You know, I've been in computing all my career, and you know, I like things to be predictable. I like overarching frameworks. I like things to be orderly. I enjoy taxonomies and ontologies and things that put things in their places. But that isn't going to work with big data. And this is one of the astonishing, to me, changes that I sort of have to be happy with. And the story is a bit more complex, but let's go it this way. If you think about the early days of the web, you'll remember the first really popular website that I ever used was Yahoo. People here, Yahoo users back in the day? Yeah, it was great. It was wonderful. As a directory, I would go down in these places, find the sites that do the things I wanted. That was in the days when people could still count web pages and people could actually categorize them. Google took the opposite approach, because there's no way that this is ever going, that Yahoo could ever scale in to the size of the actual web. So really it takes a statistical approach, and this is what big data is about as well, having a statistical approach to the massive data sets and then seeking to find meaning in them. There's a paper by Peter Norvig and others called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Data. And in this, he points out some of the problems, really, with an ontological approach to massive amounts of data. First is, it's really hard to write an ontology or a taxonomy. Really, really hard and really expensive. And what's more, all the easy ones have already been done by people. So when you get into any field of endeavor, if you're going to try and categorize data by first producing a taxonomy for it and putting everything in its place, it's a very, very expensive thing to do. And the larger the data set, the more expensive it is. And of course, that's not even taking into account that data tends to have multiple axes. And of course, a taxonomy tends to address one axis, and then you might have other axes against which to put things. So it's a hard problem. The second thing is the difficulty of implementing a scheme like this. You may have read in 2001 the Semantic Web paper by Tim Berners-Lee and his colleagues, in which they describe this future where everything on the web will be encoded in a machine-readable way. And you'll wake up in the morning and ask your computer about you know, scheduling an appointment. You have to move your doctor's appointment. It'll know the opening hours and be able to interact. Well, the problem with this Semantic Web project, which I was heartily enthusiastic about and still am, but the problem with it is it's very difficult to get people to encode their own metadata. If you look at the web, there's only really one piece of metadata back in the day that was important, which was the title tag on a web page. Darn if you couldn't get people to fill that one in. That's one tag. And I'm sure that you're aware, you know, with managing projects and systems, how difficult it is to get people to enter metadata in the first place and then to get it right. It's very hard. The third thing is that ontologies are actually a great lever for competition. If you own the means of describing a data space, you have control in that market, and people must come to you to apply for where they want to be within your taxonomy or your ontology. And the fourth thing that's a problem about these things is trust. And this is really one of the genius things about Google. A web page can represent to be whatever it wants to be. I could be selling you know, cheap gray import medicine, and I'll put, you know, in my on my webpage a brand name. Great, I'm doing it. People search for this brand, they come and they buy my cheap knockoffs, and I make lots of money. Well, that's what's called spam, right? And this is the biggest example of why having people write their own metadata is a dodgy enterprise. It's very easily gamed. And how do you manage trust at such a large level? Even within a control environment, it's very difficult to manage trust and permissions. And if you look at a large and messy data set that's available, that incorporates things from the outside world, it gets even harder. So let's reverse the model. This is what big data does. Instead of classifying each instance, let's use algorithmic means to find the natural classifications, and then we'll label them. So here's an example that you can go and do for yourself. This is a LinkedIn in map. So all my connections on LinkedIn, of whom I have about, I think, 1,300, are linked to me, and they're interlinked with each other that forms a graph. And what InMaps does is uses a simple clustering algorithm and then colors the clusters to show you some of the natural classifications that exist within your friend graph. And you can go and do this and find it. And so for me, for instance, this red cloud up to the right is O'Reilly Media, who I work for. For off to the left, the blue cloud are all my friends from the XML world 10 years ago. The orange people are in open source. The green people are what I call Web 2.0 companies, and so on. But LinkedIn doesn't know that I met all these people within that context. It's not figured anything out, frankly. It only knows that these people are connections on LinkedIn and has applied a very, very lightweight, very easy algorithm to uncover this. And so, but now we can label all these people. I have a very easy way of labeling my contacts by this interaction. So the computer's done a lot of the hard work for me. So this is a very simple example of what I'm talking about, that simple algorithms over big data can rapidly assist with otherwise very tedious tasks of labeling and classification. Well, another example that was very revealing was the Enron email data set. You remember after the scandals there, this email data set was released, and it turns out that there were very interesting patterns of interaction between certain people in the company as the scandal was developing, which were actually quite revealing. And there are several companies now that will analyze the email within your company, so you can find out very interesting things. I don't think they're all necessarily focused on fraud. Some of them are focused on things like how, as an HR department, do you find who the valuable people in your company are? You know that person that everybody knows about, that knows everything, but maybe the management don't know about them. Well, this is how to find those sort of things out. So a concept that's really appeared at the same time as big data is that of data science. Now, data science is really a handy label for the kind of folk who are creating this new kind of data product. And as usual, when a new label comes out, there's huffing and puffing because people will say, well, I've done that all along, or they're not really scientists, or whatever. I mean, so we'll just have to get past that, and I'll describe this kind of person, because I'm sure you'll know one or you'll be one. It's kind of a combination of a statistician, a programmer, an entrepreneur, and a storyteller. In his short report called Building Data Science Teams, DJ Patil describes their roles that you'll typically find them in companies. And he says you'll find them in places like running decision science and business intelligence, or in product and marketing analytics, or maybe looking after fraud, abuse, risk and security, or in data services and operations, or in engineering and infrastructure. And these people combine the ability to know and understand what data means with the ability to actually get in and do something about it. And when you have those skills of both being able to do the engineering work and being able to understand what it means and understanding a bit of the business domain knowledge, either in one person or in a small team, you can iterate a lot faster. And the real change is that, yes, it kind of does become a science then, because you can propose theories about the data in your organization and what it means. You can test them, you can explore, you can actually perform what you might call science on it. So Patel, and he, by the way, was a person at LinkedIn who really grew this data science team there, characterizes some of their attributes again. So they have, he says, technical expertise. He says they have curiosity, cleverness, and storytelling. And I do think storytelling is a very important part of analyzing data, because you can be the smartest person in the world, but if you cannot communicate to your business or to your colleagues what this data means and getting inside it, how it happened, then your analyses aren't actually worth a great deal. In essence, though, the change is you can't put data and people who work with data in a box to one side in an organization. If you're really going to take advantage of data, they need to be integrated. I spoke a month ago to quite a long-standing business intelligence company that was shipping, you know, products long before big data came around. And I asked them, you know, well, what's the biggest problem you have? And he said, well, one of our big problems is really where our customers put our product. They have an analytics team that sits in a room, and they throw their reports over the wall to the rest of the business. You know, orders come into them for reports, they do it, and they throw it out. So it all happens in isolation. There's none of this chance for a feedback loop where people who know the data are able to iterate with the rest of the business, where the business could take advantage of the data and use it to create a better product or to save costs. No, it just turns out they say, well, we'd like to know about this. And the problem with saying we'd like to know about this is you never find out what you don't know. There's never a way to discover new things. So Google and Facebook and these companies leading in big data, they don't just have better tools, but they have a much different organizational structure where the people working with data are central, and bringing data as part of the decision-making process is also central. And in fact, I'd argue that that came first, that the reason they've generated all these tools to manipulate data is because of the high value they placed on analytics in the first place. So I'm going to tell you about just a few principles of big data. One of the first is that more data usually beats better algorithms. Now, statistics has spent a long time honing its techniques to eke that better 1% and 2% predictive ability out of their models. And now we kind of don't need to do that. You saw on the LinkedIn graph, again, a simple example, but the point is that it just applied an algorithm called k-means clustering, which is a really simple piece of maths inside a computer. But a large data set enabled all these classifications to emerge. And as a little anecdote, you may remember a couple years ago there was a prize called the Netflix Prize, where Netflix released a bunch of their data and asked people to provide a better, I think, algorithm for predicting what people would like than they could. And the story about some of the winning teams is told by Anand Rajamaran, who at the time was at a company called Cosmix, is now part of Walmart Labs. So, by the way, Walmart didn't stop with Teradata and data warehousing. They are very much leading, again, in big data. But his story is this. He said, different student teams in my class adopted different approaches to the problem, using both published algorithms and novel ideas. Of these, the results from two of the teams illustrate a broader point. Team A came up with a very sophisticated algorithm using the Netflix data. Team B used a very simple algorithm, but they added in additional data beyond the Netflix set, information about movie genres from the Internet Movie Database. Guess which team did better? Well, the team that did radically better were the ones that incorporated the external data set. So this is where more data can beat better algorithms. You could look at your data and try deep to find a cause of something, or you could combine an extra data set and suddenly find a lot more information in that. So to give you sort of examples, people often talk about social media, and there is a lot of very interesting information there, particularly where you're talking about the interaction of your product with normal people. For instance, I don't think it's too far-fetched to imagine there's a lot of information about unfortunate experiences with drugs out there in social media, where people, you know, it's not working for me, I'm sick, I took this, it's not working. And this information on its own is very interesting, but how do you understand that information? Well, you could combine it with other reports you're getting about adverse reactions to a drug from the field and so on. So there are multiple ways in which you could join up data sets to get a much better model to check your existing data. And this is, you know, some of the people here are showing up others. Anand Rajaman also writes about an example. It's in 2008, where ComScore, who kind of delivered information about, I forgot that story, so, but it's on the slide, so I'll let you go and look about that. But the point is that additional information creates lots of value. And if you want a magic one, location is always the magic data set you can add to other data sets to create insight that you haven't had before. Think about, give you an example of a retailer, and they notice that certain of their stores don't do as well under the same circumstances as others. Now, well, that's great. What could that be? Well, you could add in, for instance, the locations of your competitors' stores to that information about your sales figures, and suddenly you might find out that actually the stores that don't do so well on Saturdays are because your competitors have a store nearby and it's quicker for customers to drive to, or yours is hidden away, or what can you do? Well, you can send those crazy guys with boards that wave around to stand on street corners in that instance. But location is surprisingly effective. That's a benign example. Obviously, when it comes to personal data, you could see the ways in which it's also a very sensitive data set. Okay, moving on. So a second principle about big data is to keep lots of it. When people say that big data is the new oil, you may have heard about this. This is what they're talking about. The propensity that's sometimes very surprising for large, rather mundane data sets to contain an immense amount of business value when you process them. I talked about the digital nervous system before, and everything you do in the digital world leaves a trace. If you work for Thomson Reuters, you know about this one. I was talking with their CTO a couple years ago, and they're saying these interesting search patterns they see, because, of course, when a trader searches for a particular company, they're kind of showing their hand about what they might want to do, which affects the market and so on. So what you see that they typically do is search for 10 companies with seemingly no connection between them, and one of the companies that they're searching for is the actual thing. And any of you in competitive intelligence will understand the importance of signals that are incidental or just generated by other activity that you can then derive insight from. So we're leaving traces everywhere, which turns out to be a good thing. And if that is, you know, the side effect that's enabled you to determine things, well, it kind of makes sense that you should build in leaving traces into more and more of your systems. So if you're a computer architect, you know, you shouldn't just have your systems generate log messages when there are errors. You should log everything a user does. You might find out, for instance, that your system is surprisingly difficult to use and you never knew about it or never cared about it until you see people doing all these dumb things because you're logging all the interactions every time. There's a great story of this guy called Shwetak Patel, who's doing a startup now. But he was able to analyze through the variations in levels on power lines in your house. Turns out that each of your domestic appliances leaves a particular signature in the power lines. So he's able to produce a device that could fingerprint different domestic appliances and then show you your power consumption. And how crazy is it that we buy power from the power companies, yet they can't tell us how we're using it? We could probably save, you know, a lot of money, not just by you know, doing things like not leaving lights on, but by replacing certain appliances. I think it turns out that, I know, 10 or 15% of all the electricity in the US is used up by DVRs, spinning their discs all the time, which I never knew, but this came from his work. So very often, our mental models aren't sophisticated enough when confronted with real data, especially about things that we're not experts in. Perhaps one of the canonical examples of instrumentation being used for value, again, is coming back to Google. How do they stay ahead, right? How do they know what is a great result? Well, they use every signal they can. I think there is something like 100 or 200 different signals they use to evaluate web pages. And one of the most powerful they discovered early on was not actually inherent in the web page itself, but inherent in your behavior when you did a search. So if you searched for, I don't know, let's say, you know, washing machine, and the first result you got was entirely useless to you, you come back and then you look at the second. And then that turned out to be a much better result, so you'll stay there. And so they differentiated between what they called long and short clicks. A short click on a web page was where the first result had no value, so the searcher came back and then clicked the second. And the long click is obviously where they don't come back for a long time, so the page is valuable. Then they were able to know by your interaction performing a search that to you personally, it wasn't that good a result. And then they could adjust the ranks accordingly. So they use the collective intelligence of everybody searching to say what was a good web page, that human judgment. And this is the classic thinking behind creating products out of data, is that the whole interaction, the more of your interactions of a system you can capture digitally, the more chance you have, the more signals and the more information you can capture to improve your results or create new products. It's really that kind of benign feedback loop that creates a great advantage. Now, Google, because they did that, then they captured, it's kind of self-sustaining because more people come to them, they will produce better results, which made more people come to them, and they could produce better results. And they publish on what they do. They don't keep it a trade secret because once they've done what they've done, their advantage isn't in the algorithm, isn't in the software, it's actually in the data. And that's pretty telling, and I think a trend that's really unrolling through our industry is that the software itself, there isn't really that much secret smarts or proprietary algorithmic secrets. A lot of advantage is coming from the data, and Google's other advantage, of course, came from their cheap hardware that they're able to undercut on price. So when data storage is limited, storing everything, as I've already indicated, is troublesome. You have to throw away a lot. The Large Hadron Collider at CERN generates so much information, they throw away 98% of it. Don't know if you've ever seen a picture of it, but it has a fiber optic as thick as my arm coming off the side of it, which is just an immense amount of data. And they keep, you know, they generate terabytes a day and they throw away the vast amount. But even in your organization, in regular organizations, the problems with storing information are well known. And you know, the way a lot of databases are built, they fill up. And that's how a lot of data systems have worked thus far. And we're in a change here where, you know, eventually in a few years' time, our attitude towards keeping data will change. And if Google hadn't kept all their search logs and thought that information important, they wouldn't have been able to do anything about it. So ignoring the fact that looking after the data is troublesome, let's just store it and kind of trust the fact that maybe in a few years' time we'll be able to do something with it. So in a data warehouse today, from you know the last 10 years, what happens is data comes in, maybe all the transactions from retail overnight, and they're examined and they're cleaned up. They're put into that nice, square, orderly format I was talking about. Anything that's an error is thrown away. And it's all beautiful, pristine data that goes into the the church of the data warehouse where priests tend to it and deliver perfect prayers of operational success to their masters. But that's how it was, and a lot of stuff gets thrown away. With big data, the approach is opposite. The idea is you store all of your raw incoming data. And you can do this because processing large amounts of data is now very feasible. So the reason you used to tidy it up and make it into orderly patterns was that was the only way which you could process it in time, in a reasonable amount of time. It's not a bad thing to tidy data. It was the only way you can do it. But with the massive amounts of commodity processing, now you can really leave that kind of stuff till later. And so you keep everything, you lose no information, and then it turns out that if your idea of the information you wanted to keep was wrong, you can go back and change that. And that's really one of the flexible things. And I think that's what you're going to see in information systems over the next 10 years is this approach to a massive data pool, putting structure and making sense out of it just in time rather than preordaining the structure of the data. It's going to be a very important change. And one of the most important things it will bring is a new agility inside an organization about how you process information. You won't be going into just this database over here or this database over here or this database over here, but you'll have more of a unified way of accessing information and joining it up and comparing it. And what I also hope and expect to happen is that there will be increased amount of user-friendliness in the tools that allow people access to data. I'm going to quickly speed through a few of these because apparently I enjoy talking. Big data, it's important to see it as a business problem. That's a bit of jargon, but what it means is that everybody should care about data and what it says. We shouldn't, you know, as human beings, we don't ignore, you know, the senses of our eyes and ears as we walk around. So why should a business, you know, ignore the vast amount of the data that it's generating? As humans, we have our brain to figure out what's important to us or not. And the really progress that we're seeing in big data, being able to crunch massive amounts of data sets, is to be able to make sense of all the things that the sensors in our business are telling us. So what does that mean realistically? You know, today's organizations can walk on for a while with comparative blindness, but their mental maps are going to fail them, or people who can see more than they can will overtake them. So things I've noticed that, you know, buy-in for data has to exist at the top level of not separating people who understand the domain from those who understand the maths. Combine them, mix them up. You know, there are problems with using data. If you just hand a report to a boss, they don't know how you did it. They don't know how it's computed. They don't know the potential problems with it. They could say, oh, that's a figure, and then they're off relying on some metric they found from the report you gave them without understanding how it works. And if you want to see how problematic that could be, consider an HR department that finds out, fabulous, we've discovered by measuring where all our employees live that we get less turnover with the ones that live nearby. So now we're only going to hire people who live nearby. That makes perfect sense. And a boss could run with that. Wow, thank you. You know, I've saved millions of dollars and lots of productivity and increased productivity by not having so much staff turnover. Except it turns out the only people who can live nearby are rich white people. And then all of a sudden, your organization, by relying on what appears to be a very sensible metric, is racist. And so the point is that you have to understand both the maths and the business domain in order to make good judgments on data, and that this is often subtle and can bite you in the ass, and it's not easy. Which is kind of an unfortunate message sometimes to send up the chain, isn't it? But there we go. So be prepared for organizational change to happen if you really want, as an organization, to be data-driven and take advantage. So where are we right now with the master plan for data? I don't know if any of you are fans of the cartoon South Park, but there's a sketch in here where it's very surreal, but there are underpants being stolen by lots of gnomes, and they ask these gnomes, well, what's the deal here? Well, this is our business plan. And right now, for a lot of people, this is the big data business plan. Let's collect all the data, and then we'll be rich. Well, it turns out that actually phase one is spectacularly difficult anyway. You guys all manage data, and you know that is not an easy problem, managing access to it. And if you want to integrate more than one database with another, that's also a phenomenally difficult problem. There was a lot of hoo-ha a few years ago about data marketplaces where you could buy on-demand data rather than big databases. Well, a lot of them didn't really get off to a great start, and why not? Because there was nowhere for people to put the data in the other end, on the other end of the organization. It's great if I can buy a Ferrari, but I'm not going to drive it in California because there are far too many potholes in the road. And the point is, it's great if I can get this data, I can't manipulate it, I'm not going to bother buying it. So also inside an organization, actually getting to data can often run up against political problems and silos. It's not uncommon inside organizations for historical data to be in completely different places than active data. Great, I can tell you everything about customers in the last 3 months, but if you want to know the last 10 years, you're going to have to go down a corridor to a dusty room where somebody keeps the archives. But it could turn out there's a lot of value in that data that can make predictions about what your next 3 months are going to be like. But we are trying to push into this phase two and understand some of the patterns of change. Some of it's happening in training up of these people called data scientists. You'll notice now there are a lot of master's courses in schools for data science where they get taught combining these skills of using databases with stats and visualization. The vendors are getting better at building tools that actually let people do work. And organizations are getting better at understanding what an architecture looks like for big data. And that's one of my projects this year, to be able to understand what the leaders are doing and be able to tell that story out. But I can tell you that the companies that I've seen that really get data are talking about building data as a platform in their organization where access to data is something that can happen in an agile way, that a software developer or an analyst can sum up the data they want through a tool, have access, perform analysis, and move on. Contrast that against a not unusual situation where in a kind of a BI and a reporting world, you'd ask for a new field and a report, and it would take 3 months to do, and then it would come back because. And the reasons for that were good reasons. They weren't because IT was very defensive and trying to tell you you couldn't have all that information. Well, maybe they were. But it also turns out that data is interlinked and affects each other, and adding a new field to a report may seem very simple to you, but to the poor guy who has to do it, they have to ripple back all through their systems and undo a lot of things that have been done and add and test every part of the pipeline. So creating an agile infrastructure for data, I think, is going to be one of the most important things that we'll see. But the real thing is that there's no one-size-fits-all phase two for how you really get benefit from data in your organization. Because it's not a solution-first thing, right? I said it's a business problem. Data is really, the value of data to you is really about what problems do you need to solve first. Think about that problem. Think about what extra data can help you. And now with big data, things that you didn't think were possible before, like asking what is the world at large thinking about this, now become available to you. There are a lot of great tools available, and I would just say that if you don't have any experience using stats tools or any basic computer programming, give it a go. Go and get in there and tinker with some of these things because I think it will give you a facility for understanding the opportunities that are out there. I don't think there's any reason today that anybody shouldn't tinker or program or have a play. There are a lot of great tools online. One of my favorite places of people who are non-programmers using data is actually the Guardian website. They have a blog called the Data Blog, where their journalists have really pioneered getting into data sets using very simple tools to manipulate them and showing stories or showing background to news stories. And these tools, I think, apply for anybody. I'll give the link to the slides to Alex, and actually, I put the notes in on where the links are, and there's a URL and a bunch of references for the things I've talked about today. So go in and tinker. Go and put your credit card into Amazon and have a play with Hadoop. It's kind of fun. So where's this heading? What does this actually mean to people who manage information? Because as we're busy reinventing data infrastructure at scale, there are plenty of things from the small data world that don't exist yet in big data. And you might quite reasonably say, well, it's great having all this data and I can see these solutions, but I can't control who gets access to this data. That's never going to fly in my organization. I had a great time wandering around talking to people yesterday, and I heard the story where, one department in the company can't know what the other department in the company is doing. It's not even between companies. So I know that there are very real implications here. And there are things that are yet unaddressed that I think people here might play a very important part in. So what else do we need to know about data? Well, we need to understand its provenance. if we were to be able to deliver advice about actions we should take, we need to understand, as you know very well, where the data came from. And currently, this is, you know, the big data world is really, if it was a baseball game, it's the top of the second, right? I haven't even bought my garlic fries yet. So provenance is one thing that's not really addressed yet, and one of the very important things, especially in a regulatory environment. The second thing is kind of indexing and location of the data sets themselves. If I'm storing all my data in this big pool, where can I find the data? How, if I'm going to equip people in my organization to get value out of data and be of value to the company, can I make sure they can find the data they want very quickly? That doesn't exist yet. And I know that we live in a world where there are multiple databases inside organizations, and frankly, you probably need different sets of logins for each, depending on who you are, and it's great if you've got single sign-on. If you haven't, you've got all that. So there's a large data management problem. What about dependencies? If you have all this data in an organization, who's depending on it? If you cancel a data set or if you adjust one, whose business unit is going to complain when you do that? And how do we manage that information? And you know, if you turn off a service, whose reports aren't going to generate overnight? Auditing is yet unaddressed. Who has touched the data? How is it transformed? I don't think people should be forced to believe that analytics and data manipulation is voodoo, right? There is a sense in which it's unfortunate that executives might come and say, I want this analyticed. Or these days they'll say, I want it Hadooped. And then magic will come out. You need to be able to trace what you've done, both for security reasons, but also for understanding why it is you're saying what you're saying in an organization. The thing to say about these solutions for big data is I don't expect them to look exactly the same as today's solutions for small amounts of data are. We know that with controlled databases, we can manage them in a certain way. For large amounts of data sets that are integrated, possibly expanding, possibly including data that's wild from the web, I don't expect that these solutions will look exactly the same. I hope that in the same way I showed with the LinkedIn InMaps, where computers helped us group and classify, computers as well can do more of the legwork for us in helping us manage the data sets. So there's a lot of opportunity for applying algorithms to help us manage things. I should point out, by the way, that not all is lost for the ontology. Google's actually started building information from a knowledge database into their results now. But they've done it the other way around. So instead of relying on a thing that knows everything about everything, they use statistical methods, and then they're now able to augment search results with structured information that they found. So they do have a use for it. It's just the order and the lens which they look through it. So I'm not here to diss the Semantic Web Project. I actually think that big data is the best thing that could happen to it because it gets around the problem of labeling, gets around the problem of people writing their own metadata. So as more of the world can be measured, your organization is becoming a lot more like a laboratory than it ever was before. And all the things that make you a good scientist and a good leader in real life apply there too. And I think above all, the thing that people need to understand in an era of data is how to ask the right questions. Things like critical thinking, curiosity, a fair dose of intuition become ever more important. So the characteristics that make a great scientist apply in a data-driven organization. So I'm going to give you quickly some resources to go to. Again, these will be in the slides, so don't worry about writing it all down. There's a great book called The Human Face of Big Data, which was produced by a photographer called Rick Smolin last year. This is a beautiful book full of wonderful stories and color photos that anybody can understand really the change that's going on as things become more measurable and computable. A book that's just come out that really helped you think about this in a business context and in a historical context too is by Victor Meyer-Schoenberger and Ken Cukier. It's called simply Big Data. But Ken Cukier was the journalist in 2011 who wrote the very influential Economist report on big data that kind of set a lot of the mainstream interest off. And he's very, very thoughtful, and there's great analogies and great stories that underpin each of the principles of big data in this book. I edit a journal on big data, which I heartily recommend you check out. I think we've got a bunch of copies in the exhibit hall that you can go and have a look at. I'm very interested in both readers and contributors as we get this going. I also chair the Strata Conference, which, if you just want the full-on blow-your-mind experience of where this industry is, please consider attending. I think everybody from people engaged in sort of business all the way through to the real, very technical people working on the lowest levels. But our tagline for that is making data work, which I think is my personal philosophy on the whole thing. It's about using data to generate value. So that's it for me. I just think, leave you as a closing thought, that there's people in this room who are managers of information and managers of data in our organizations. It's really our attitudes that are going to help shape how our companies and the places we work for use that. If we get into this and understand that data needs to be transformed from having an assistive role to a point where it can be a real genesis of new value, new product, new insight, new ideas, if we can understand that change and then advocate for that change, then that's going to help our organizations as a whole. So thanks very much. Time for questions, I think, in just a few minutes.
I think we have just a couple minutes. Let's give a big thank you to Ed.
Thank you.
And if there are one or two questions, please wait till I give you the mic. That way the folks that are online that can hear as well. Are there any questions? Wow. Okay. It's going to take me a few minutes, but I need my exercise, so this is excellent. Yay.
Hi, I'm Mary Chitty, chair of PHT, and I was very interested both to hear you say that more data is better, because I've been saying we don't have enough data, and we need even more, but the simpler algorithm. But my question is about not hiding data away in IT. Do you have any suggestions, and you offered some, about how we can better partner and communicate with IT?
Well, I think the answer is in the question, really, isn't it? And I think it's a very good point. What's happening in big data is actually set against a background of transformation in enterprise IT at this time as well, where enterprise IT, the smart folks are realizing that they can't really be central planning anymore for their organizations, because if they are, people will just simply go around them. You know, when you can put a credit, if you have a couple programmers in your team, they can put a credit card into Amazon and get your results tomorrow, whereas they might be looking for a 3-month equipment requisition from IT before doing it, then they'll take the path of least resistance. And that's the change that's going on in IT right now. And so they need to be partners in this. They do have value. They need to, they're again, the guardians of corporate, you know, policy. They don't, you know, it's not a good idea if all the data goes leaking out everywhere on Amazon. There's very real reasons for not doing these things. But instead of shutting them down, I hope that the best teams will work with the business to enable things to be done in a safe way. So, as you said, I think communication and education is the best way. I see IT in transition right now. Perhaps it's a little schizophrenic where some people get it and some people feel very defensive at the moment.
Great. We have one more question here.
Hi. Regarding the IT bit, I've sat in almost every role that is possible in the business around IT on both sides. IT doesn't restrict data access. It's the business that restricts data access. Drug safety and regulatory does not want a lot of this data exposed, because if we learn things about it, we have to report it. And if we have to report it, it usually kills our market. So we have to get an understanding of how to use the data and agreement with the FDA and EMA before we can move forward with this level of big data or this approach in a lot of what we're doing. I was kind of curious. To me, semantics and semantically tagging data and data types is almost required to be able to do large-scale analyses. When you pointed out the unsupervised learning that LinkedIn does, there's still some semantics there that have to be taken into account. Even to do unsupervised learning, to start doing supervised learning, you have to have even more semantics. So I was just curious if you could elaborate.
I agree. I mean, You know, clearly there are things that you can only do when you can't generate information out of thin air, and for domains which you suggest, where you absolutely must know something about the data, there's no alternative. To take your larger point, which I think is something I didn't talk about, which I should have done, is that perhaps one of the biggest questions that data is raising right now are ones of policy and interaction with policy, because clearly you put in a very heavily regulated industries, it's a big old problem. You can't, you know, for instance, make diagnoses based on, you know, this wonderful bit of machine learning, because you can't explain why you made a diagnosis, and therefore nobody's, you know, going to pay for it. And lots of other reasons like that. And there's this huge debate about personal privacy, which is a big hot button issue for many of us. I think the story in the large about regulation and data mining is that it's a dialogue, and that there is a halfway house where some degree of relaxation in permission about what you can do with data is going to deliver certain amounts of value, and there's going to be trust have to be built up and results have to be seen. You know, at a very basic level, I trust Google with my information because I know it gives me results back. I don't mind telling Google what I'm looking for because I get more value back than I give up in giving that information. And that trade-off of the value you give up versus the value you get is going to land on different parts of the secrecy disclosure spectrum depending on an industry or the regulatory environment. And it is unfortunate, particularly in healthcare, where perhaps there are very, very large benefits to be gained from big data, that because of HIPAA and the like, a lot of the patient health records are actually hard to get together.
HIPAA's killing a lot of people.
Yeah, it really is. The comment for the webcast, HIPAA's killing a lot of people. One of the interesting stories I'll just finish on was I spoke to the authors of the Big Data book, and apparently their book is the best-selling business book in China for five weeks running now. And there's a tremendous amount of interest in big data. And I think Victor Mayer Schoenberg was relating to me that the Chinese see this as an opportunity to leap ahead. And one of their advantages they've got, of course, is a reasonably homogenous information infrastructure. If they wanted to use all their patient records to do analysis and perform, really improve healthcare with data, they can. They don't have that standing in their way. So it's very important economic arguments that could be made as well for loosening of these regulations.
Again, let's give a big thank you to Ed.
Thank you.